This programme was produced at and first aired on MPR, Manawatu People's Radio, with support from New Zealand On Air. Ka pai, irirangi te motu, MPR. If you're enjoying this podcast in Manawatu, you could make your very own, just like this one. MPR exists to help people like you tell your story or share your passion on air and online. Check out mpr.nz for more information.
Welcome to Manawatu Conversations, recollections of the past and sometimes opinions about the future.
Today we have with us
Margaret Bates,
Ross Kessels,
Brian Bates,
and Vicky Marie Buchanan. So Brian, welcome. We're hearing today your life story, which is fantastic. And you were telling us that you have lived in Palmerston North for about 40 years?
40 to 50 years.
40 to 50 years. Yes. And you were the pharmacist at the Cook Street Pharmacy.
That's right, yep.
So there'd be some really interesting stories about that, wouldn't there, coming through?
Oh, yes. Quite a few stories happened in my pharmacy career. It's not just in Cook Street, but I've had a career in the UK as well. So
right.
There's a lot of things to say about my career in pharmacy, yes.
Oh, yes. Great. So, let's go back. So, you were born in the UK?
I was born in the UK in the London borough of Barking and Dagenham. I was born in Barking, but we lived in Dagenham.
Right.
And I was born as a baby in 1936.
Okay, righty-ho. And so, you lived there for how long?
I lived in Dagenham till I was about 26.
Oh, okay.
And that was the point when I came to New Zealand, but that's another story, that's further on.
So,
yes.
Born in 36.
Yes.
And for 26 years. So that took you through to World War II?
Yes. Right. The war started in 1939, and there was the quiet period when it first started, but as things started to hot up, we were evacuated to a place called Wellington in Somerset.
Okay.
But at my age, I didn't remember much about that.
Right.
So that was the early days. But we later on had to come back to London because during the Blitz, my father worked in the docks, and London was pounded by the Luftwaffe.
Mm.
The whole dock system in London was moved to Scotland.
Okay.
And so we moved to Scotland, and the convoys would come up the Clyde into a place called Greenock, which is just outside Glasgow.
Right.
And we lived there for some time, and I've got great memories of that now.
Mm.
Things start to remember. I can remember all the convoys coming into the Clyde.
Right.
Some of them quite battered, actually. And that's something that did stick in my mind at that time. I started school in Gourock. We weren't living in Greenock. We lived in Gourock, which is just along from Greenock.
Mm-hmm.
I started school there. And, of course, when I eventually came back to London, I was speaking with a strong Scottish accent.
So as you were going through in the war period, it was from 3 to 10 years old, would it be?
Yes, that's right. When we came back to... in the latter days in Scotland, Dad was in a protected industry. He didn't have to serve in the forces.
Right.
But it annoyed my mum. He made the decision that he would do that.
Right.
I think he was pressured because this is closer to the end of the war, when it was seen that in the various areas where the war was taking place, that the ports that were destroyed had to be reserved. And that's what Dad was good at. That was his job. So he joined the forces, and it wasn't very long before he got a commission, and eventually he was a captain in the Royal Engineers.
Mm.
So we had to come back to London. But at that time, the Blitz was still going on, and one of my memories, of course, is the dive bombers, the Stukas, coming down, and you could hear the screaming and the explosion. We had quite a lot of bombing all around us.
Mm.
Fortunately, we never got hit, but our ceilings came down a few times, but It wasn't very pleasant.
Frightening, wouldn't it? Absolutely frightening, wouldn't it?
It was frightening.
Especially to a child.
It was frightening. Yeah. Then I got some memories. Another memory I have is looking up and seeing DC-3's Dakotas with their black and white stripes on the wings towing gliders.
Okay. Yeah.
That was the preparation for Dunkirk, of course.
Right.
Or D-Day.
And D-Day as well.
Yeah. Right.
And all this was going on because we had quite a few aerodromes close by. The nearest was Hornchurch, which was Fighter Command. And so there was all that activity going on. These are the sorts of memories I had as a child. One of the other memories I had was sleeping in a Morrison shelter, which was an indoor shelter, a big metal table, virtually, where we slept under.
Right.
Whether it protected us in a direct heat hit, I don't know.
Yeah.
But that was that. Then the next shelter was the Anderson shelter, which was the dugout.
Oh,
and
that was
in the garden.
Was it? Yes.
And we used to have to go into that when the horrible siren, that's another memory, the sound of the siren going.
Right.
That sent us into fears. Then, of course, later on became the famous V1s and V2s. We call them buzz bombs or doodle bugs, they were scary. The V1s, of course, you could hear coming. The sound was guttural, it was awful. Then it would stop, and you would wait for the explosion. And if the explosion wasn't you, then you'd breathe a sigh of relief. But of course, the V2s, no sound. They just came over. And but fortunately, this was close to the end of the war. The Allies were advancing into Germany, and they found Peenemünde, where these things, the V1s and V2s, were taken off, closed it all off, and so we survived. If that hadn't have happened, I think we would have had a different world.
Yes.
Britain
would
have got completely annihilated, I believe. So that was it. So I guess, in a way, it's given you some insight of what the war meant to me as a young
boy. Absolutely. How did you, and you were a young boy, how did you process that? I mean, that's huge traumas that you're living through as well. Did you talk about it with your parents, or did you all just get on? Or, you know, you say that now you've got those memories that are with you.
Yes. It's quite funny because I don't think I actually processed it as such in those days. It was part of our life. We had rationing, for example. That was part of our life. We lived on offal and rabbits.
Offal and rabbits.
Offal and rabbits. And rationing. I mean, it was unbelievable. I'll give you an example. We had an egg ration, for example.
Right.
You'd bring your egg home, and you'd have to crack it into a cup.
Right.
If it was rotten, you could take it back to the grocer, and he would give you a replacement.
Yeah. Right.
Because the industry wasn't like it is now.
Yes, yes.
These are all free-range eggs that we got.
Yes, yes.
Those are the kind of things. A little bit of cheese we had, a little bit of butter. So it was more that life, the ones I would describe as far as the war is concerned, is there. I actually see it more now when I watch on television the horrors in
Ukraine. Right. Yeah.
And I think,
back,
gosh, this is terrible. We had it in London.
Yes,
London was annihilated.
The
Blitz was shocking. So
it's sort of post with the rationing that, you know, you got on and
we
lived through it.
So as a child, I guess most of the horror was taken up by appearance. We were protected in a certain way as. I can't really explain it.
Right.
But it's only striking me now, or in latter years, how awful it was. But at the time, it was
something you lived through.
Because
everyone was living through it.
It wasn't
odd.
No. Everyone was living it.
Yes. As you were talking, I was thinking how that must be for the Ukrainians too.
Exactly.
Different but similar, and they have their memories as well.
That's right. I mean, I think about the particularly the V1s when they came across. This was the first of rockets coming over and bombing. Well, that's what's happening now with the Russians hitting Ukraine and in a lot greater way. It's rather frightening.
And the sounds, sounds of the sirens, sounds of it all, absolutely. Yep. So, and rationing, you went on. How long did rationing last?
Well, that went on right into after the war, into the 50s, actually. And in fact, Britain was still on its knees, and it wasn't for the Marshall Plan, for the Americas came to Britain's rescue, and we look at America sometimes askance at some of the things that go on there with the modern-day Trumpism and what have you, but the Americans rescued Europe.
Right.
There's no question about that. And the Marshall Plan was specifically organised for Britain, and that helped Britain get back to...
I didn't realise it was Britain too. I knew it was applied with Germany and Japan.
No, no, it's also...
But I didn't realise it was Britain
It's Britain too, yes. Oh, no, the,
so what is the Marshall Plan?
It was basically Americans... helping Europe recover financially, possibly loans and what have you, but also it was a major thing. But it helped to get Britain and Europe out of. Then of course, after that we had Russia sort of turning against the West, the Cold War, Berlin airlift, and all that sort of thing. This all happened in the 50s, so that was a difficult time too. So finally rationing came off, and I can remember the first banana I had.
Which had come in from Asia, had it? The bananas?
Well, either that or the Philippines. I really don't
certainly
know.
Certainly weren't grown in the UK, were they?
No. Because this is the whole point. Exotic imports just didn't come in.
No.
We just survived on what we could do. I mean, again, this emphasises little memories that one has when you're young.
Yes.
And I can remember the first banana.
Yeah,
I had.
Coming through. Mm. Yes.
How old would you have been when you had that banana?
That banana, I would have been 12 or 13, I suppose. 12, 11.
Yes.
Just about at the
School days were obviously with the war going on at that time. You didn't go to school, or you did go to school?
Yes, we went to a primary school in Barking. It was a really old Victorian building with no greenery around it. In fact, we actually had school sports in the road outside the school. And that was done because there weren't very many cars around.
Yeah. Mm.
So I can remember lining up in 100-metre dash in the middle of the street. This was there.
Down the cobblestones?
Yes. No, not cobblestones. We weren't that age. That is it. So that was the infant school, primary school.
Mm.
And then finally... I went to my secondary school or grammar school. I managed to pass the 11 plus.
The 11 plus?
Which is GCE. It's not GCE, beg pardon. It's just 11 plus. It's an exam taken when you're 11.
Okay.
To determine how good you were.
What class you go into when you go to secondary school.
To get into a grammar school, you had to pass the 11 plus examination. Managed that.
So then in your subjects that you were interested in, I'm sort of aware that you went into science based with pharmacy work. So when did you become interested in your science, or tell us?
That happened in the grammar school. First of all, you started just a general education, all the subjects that we take, children take now, and at a certain point, and I think it was when we were 13, we started at 11. After 2 years, we had to make a decision whether we were arty or science.
Right.
So I chose science.
Right. So and arty was?
Arty would be history,
right.
geography, art subjects, as opposed to science subjects specifically. And I took the science stream and gradually got interested in it, and mainly featured in botany, zoology, chemistry and physics. Plus we did maths and English as but those were the four subjects we did. And we got through that till I got into the sixth form, and then suddenly had to make a decision on what I wanted to do. And in my young idealist situation, I wanted to be a marine biologist. Why did I want to do that? Because Jacques Cousteau was on at the time.
Oh, yes.
So that's what I wanted to do, but I actually got a position at Hull University studying microbiology. I'd been accepted for that, and that's what I was going to do. But unfortunately, I failed physics. And I couldn't, they wouldn't take me.
Right.
So I was at a loss, really. And one day I was at home and the phone rang. We did have a phone then. And it was the local educationist, I suppose, career advisor, not attached to a school, but with the city council, the borough council kind of a thing. Rang, how are you going, Brian? What are you doing? I said, nothing really. He said, well, how would you like to come and see me and we'll have a chat? Which I went. And he said, well, what are you going to do? I said, I don't know. he said, well, have you ever thought of pharmacy? I thought, what?
No.
I had no idea about pharmacy. So, to cut a long story short, he organised an interview for the local branch, Boots Branch manager.
Boots Pharmacy.
Boots Pharmacy. And so I went there and had a chat. And he said, yes, good career, why not? And so he made another appointment for me to see the territorial general manager. I went there and they found me a position which was in Old Street in the City of London, just along from Moorgate.
Okay.
There I did my apprenticeship, because we did apprenticeships in those days.
Right, right.
And so I was an apprenticed apothecary for a couple of years. And then...
apprenticeship, so... What does that mean? How many years is that? And
that was 2 years, just simply working in the shop with Boots. Also, while I was there, set examinations and study systems. And which I did as I went along. So it was a learning process.
Right, right.
An experience process on what pharmacy was all about.
Right. So Boots did it. It wasn't...
Boots did it.
It wasn't a general body anybody, just Boots.
The this is a big company. I mean, there were, I think it was 1,100 branches in Britain at that stage.
Okay.
So it was big.
Yeah.
Yeah. And they still are big. And came the time when... I then had to get to pharmacy school and carry on my education, and the nearest one was Brighton, and I couldn't get in there, so I was at a bit of a loss. But Boots came to the rescue and they found me a place in Sunderland.
Right.
I didn't know where Sunderland was.
No, I'm thinking, I'm trying to imagine it myself, as you're saying.
It's right, I'd say it's in the northeast, just south of Newcastle.
Right.
But there it was. Sunderland was it. So I went up to Sunderland and studied my pharmacy and got my degree in Sunderland, because they were attached to Durham University, and became qualified. During that time, Boots were very good to me, because during the holidays I could go and work in a local branch in Dagenham, so that helped.
Yes.
But also Boots paid for all my books. All my study books. And I thought that was wonderful. They really looked after me.
Really supportive.
And
a bit like an intern program, isn't it?
It is really. Of its time, it was very good. And I've got a lot to thank that company for. Then when I finally qualified, I became an employee of Boots. And for a couple of years, I was a relief pharmacist going in a territory that existed from Aldgate in the City of London right through to Southend, which is along the Thames, if you can imagine a long line that goes from Aldgate to Southend along the line of the River Thames out to the estuary. There's about 40 branches in that little area, and I went to most of those relief working. As time went on, I knew that I was coming to be appointed a manager. This is what happened. You do a year or two of relieving, then they'll find you a managerial job. But at that time, I wanted to go overseas. That's what young people wanted to do at that time.
Still do.
As it happens, at that time, the company started to advertise for three positions in the company overseas. They weren't retail business, because Boots also had a major manufacturing and wholesale division too. But this was overseas in, of all places, Nairobi, Singapore, and Jamaica.
Wow, okay.
And I applied to those jobs and got on the shortlist and attended my shortlist interview, and he said, well, since you've been here, something else has cropped up. There's a position occurred in New Zealand. I said, oh yeah, that's nice. He said, and you're it.
You don't have a choice.
Well, exactly. And I said, well, okay, but if I turn that down, can I still be considered for the other three jobs? No, it's that or nothing.
Wow, okay.
So, bingo, I had to make a decision, not there and then. I went home, give me time, and talked to my mum. I was an only child. Dad had died, and it was a difficult decision.
Yeah.
But mum said, well, if you want to, take it. If it's good, it'll be good. If it's not, you can come home and that'll be fine. So she sort of encouraged me, but I know she didn't want me to go.
Yeah.
So to cut a long story short again, I chose the job.
New Zealand. So what age were you at this point when you're making
25.
Yeah. It's still hard though, isn't it? You're leaving your mum, you're leaving your family, and as you say, being the only child.
Yes.
At that time when you were starting off with pharmacy, I'm thinking now medications now, of course, there's so many. What were the medications? What was your, you know, thinking back, what was your insight a little bit about?
Because nowadays, pharmacists count pills, as they're called. We call them tablets. But we actually had to manufacture medicines. We made up cough mixtures and indigestion mixtures.
Right.
We made pills.
Right.
We did all sorts. We were actually pharmacists doing the job then.
Right.
We weren't just pill counters. I guess, in a way, I was the last of the students that learned all that stuff. I don't think pharmacists do that now because they don't have to. But, you know, we made ointments up and everything. It was almost made up.
So there's your chemistry and your physics and everything coming into play, wouldn't it be?
Into play,
And the root source of that, the cough mixtures and things like that, were they plant-based? They were plant-based?
More or less. Synthetic pharmacy was in its infancy then.
Right.
When I think back, barbiturates, sulfonamides, antibiotics, just penicillin had just come in.
Right.
Before that, sulfonamides were the thing of choice. All these were synthetically made.
Right.
In fact, incidentally, Mayan Baker's work came from Dagenham. One thinks of Dagenham as being a working class sort of... Well, it is a working class city. But quite a few good things came out of Dagenham. Present company not accepted, but for example, I'll give you for an example some people that you will know of: John Farnham, Sandy Shaw, Dudley Moore. One of the Archbishops of Canterbury, but I'm not sure which one, was born in Dagenham. Bobby Moore came from Barking. So, you know, a lot of people came from Dagenham. But Mayan Bakers, of course, they invented sulfonamides and worked that.
So in the time frame, when was that? Was that the 50s or the 60s?
50s,
1950s, yeah, 50s. As well.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Oh, interesting, isn't it? Mm. Okay, well, next week we look forward to hearing about your adventures when you get to New Zealand. You came on ship to New Zealand or flew? How did you?
I wanted to come on by a boat, but they wouldn't let me. They wanted me over quickly.
Ooh.
I had to fly over on a Boeing 707.
Wow. Wow. Okay, we look forward to hearing all about that next week. Thank you.
This is part one of two. Listen next week for part two.
Thank you for listening to Manawatu Conversations. This and other recent programs can also be found on the Manawatu People's Radio website, and a range of programs is also available on the Manawatu Heritage website of the Palmerston North City Archive. The address for that is manawatuheritage.pncc.govt.nz.
If you enjoy this NPR podcast, please consider subscribing. Our podcasts are available on all major podcasting platforms, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and Spotify, as well as the accessmedia.nz app. Support this show and others like it by giving a donation. For more information, go to www.npr.nz/donate.